Hey, y'all. I'm Erin Haynes, the host of The Amendment, a brand new weekly podcast on gender, politics, and power brought to you by the 19th News and Wonder Media Network. You've probably heard the news that this election year, our democracy is at stake. On The Amendment, I'm breaking down what that actually means, specifically for the marginalized folks who depend on our democracy the most. This is a show that dives past the headlines and gets clear on the unfinished work of our democracy. Listen to The Amendment now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey fam, it's Amara. Welcome to the Trans Lives Podcast, a show where we tell trans stories to save trans lives. April 22nd was Earth Day, but climate change and environmental injustice are all year-round issues, even issues maybe stretching across the decades. And you might be wondering, what do climate change and trans rights have to do with each other? The truth is that they are undeniably linked in so many ways. First off, the rigidity in thinking about gender, you know, that gender can't change and it's fixed and it'll always remain constant, is often applied to the issue of climate change by opponents of addressing the climate crisis, who believe that the climate is stable and there is nothing that anyone can do to ever change it. But it's also the case that there are so many trans people who are on the front lines of climate justice, meaning that the intersections are both not only ideological, but also personal. Moreover, personally for me, I think that there's nothing more trans than nature, but hey, that's just me speaking for myself. So I wanted to explore all of these social and ecological intersections with two people working to protect our planet. First, I'm joined by educator and storyteller Vanessa Raddatz, who unpacks the connections between the fight for environmental justice and trans liberation.
All of these different ways in which our communities are already transforming and transfiguring grief into action is so necessary in order to combat the eco grief that so many young people are experiencing.
Next, I'll chat with Arapaho organizer Big Wind Carpenter about their experience protesting pipelines and mobilizing their community against environmental racism.
80% of the world's biodiversity is being protected by indigenous people, while we only make up less than 4% of the human population. That's not by coincidence.
But before we get to these rich and urgent conversations, let's start out, as always, with some trans joy. Environmental justice isn't a one-size-fits-all issue. Gender, race, and nationality all come into play in the fight for environmental equity. Amasai Jeke is a young indigenous Itaoke Fijian working at the critical intersection of gender equality, LGBTQI rights, and climate action. And honestly, she's been a part of too many working groups and initiatives for me to just list them all right here. But let's just say that her activism is wide-reaching and includes testifying at a United Nations Convention on Climate Change as a member of the Women's Major Group for Sustainable Development. She's also worked as a project support officer for the Rainbow Pride Foundation. She was also a member of the Pacific Urgent Action Hub on Climate and Ecological Justice in Fiji. Amasai currently serves as a program coordinator at Utopia Washington, which serves queer and trans Pacific Islander communities. Here she is to tell us more.
I am worried that by 2030, I won't have an island home to go back to in Fiji. So my hope is in a lot of love and care for this work on climate. We need to always be in solidarity. And while we know that, you know, this pathway may be challenging, it takes one step at a time. But that step is very urgent, and it requires all of us, especially us as queer and trans, as two-spirited LGBTQI community, we need to take up spaces within the climate movement, because it's the queer analysis, it's the trans analysis that's missing in terms of the way that we've been navigating systems of oppression and the way that we've been taking care of each other. It's the same way we need to take care of our land. That's really about a better world for all of us.
Amasai Jeke, you are trans joy. I now want to welcome queer eco-justice project educator and storyteller, Vanessa Raddatz. Vanessa and their collaborator, Desi Fontenot, founded the Queer Eco-Justice Project together in 2016. At that project, they organize at the intersection of ecological justice and queer liberation. Vanessa also brings these important themes to film. Their first documentary project follows queer and trans communities in Northern California and Puerto Rico through years of disasters. It's called Fire and Blood: Queer Resilience in the Era of Climate Change. Their newest project is an exciting collaboration with queer, trans, and two-spirit organizers in Florida. It's entitled Can't Stop Change and explores the way that anti-queer attacks and climate change are deeply linked while creating a roadmap for how communities can weather environmental disaster and state violence. Additionally, Vanessa is part of a working group at Out for Sustainability, which focuses on environmental justice by and for queer communities. Additionally, they're a PhD student in educational theory and practice at the University of Georgia. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to speak with you again.
Yes, it's been a couple of years due to COVID. I saw you at Bioneers and it was great to meet you there. So I'm excited to talk. I'm going to start with a strange question potentially to your ears, and that is, what's the connection between ecological justice, climate justice, and trans rights and the fight for trans liberation?
Oh, absolutely. This is a great question. It's not a strange question at all. This is actually what is the top of my mind most of my academic and organizing life. And I think it comes down to a number of really key concepts in queer and trans ecologies. And one of those is this idea, this very concept of what is nature and what is unnatural. Because these ideas are some of the source of homophobia, transphobia, some of these attacks that we're seeing right now, is the idea that queer and trans people are unnatural. It's written into anti-sodomy laws across the country, the idea that sodomy is a crime against nature. And it's brought up a lot right now in these bills that are jeopardizing healthcare for trans young people, trans people of all ages, is the idea that these are unnatural changes. And so I think that getting to that level and lifting up trans ecologies is on so many levels a key to helping us weather this moment. The idea of trans ecologies, I think there are just so many different like tendrils and tentacles to go down. But when I'm bringing it to perhaps like a youth group audience, or even in, you know, social movement kind of workshop spaces, I like to start with, there's this little quiz that Desi, the co-founder of Queer Eco-Justice Project, created, where we just, you know, we put all these different animals and plants like up on a screen, and then we read out these different little factoids about their lives and ask people to pick which one. And one of them where people always just, you know, you can like sense this feeling of belonging is when we talk about clownfish and all of these different are more than human kin, these fish, that will transform their entire bodies, sometimes multiple times over the course of their lives, all the way down to their gametes, their very, you know, the sex cells, right, will turn from egg to sperm, from sperm to egg. And they do this, quote unquote, naturally, right? But, you know, this idea of nature and it being something that's separate from culture is just such a root issue when it comes to queer and trans futures. And it's an idea that hasn't always been around. It's an idea that really comes out of this enlightenment, this Christian empire-infused enlightenment that was then spread around the world through colonialism and to the modern day with neoliberal globalization really enforcing these same kind of ways of viewing the world as being the only ways to understand our bodies and to understand our genders. I think that when we can peel away some of that centuries-old indoctrination and really look at the world around us with more curious eyes, we see that it's a very queer and trans nature that we emerge from.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think that one of the things I think about just as a principle is that nothing in nature stays the same.
Like
there's nothing in nature that starts out something and it's that for its entire cycle. The very definition, a key principle in nature is transformation. And transformation that is rooted in fundamental shifts. And you're explaining to us how the shifts can be even more fundamental than the things that we witness with regards to nature. So I think it's a really powerful idea and a powerful reality that's all around us that we've denied because of the need to impose control because of the reasons that you outlined.
Yeah, absolutely. Like in the academic headspace, Susan Stryker wrote this prologue to a new book called Transecologies, where Stryker writes that, you know, quote, the enemy of my nature is a capital N nature that is home to man, but not to me. And I come back to this a lot because I think that, one, it highlights this idea that nature is constructed, but we can find a belonging in the natural world through kind of a reclamation of our own nature, and that what we are doing in transfiguring our human bodies and transforming our societies is a force of nature. Exactly what you're saying, like nature changes. You can't stop that. The process of flowers emerging was a process of increasing the speed of diversification. I think that like things like that are really important for us to lift up in our social movements to reconnect us with a sense, a deep, and for me, spiritual, but for others, perhaps scientific sense of belonging in the world.
Hmm. So tell us from your lens, how is nature doing? And I'm not asking this from a perspective of climate skepticism. I'm asking you, honestly, to push us a little beyond what we generally know, which is that the climate is warming. It's being driven by these capitalistic forces that are also the ones that are behind the repression and oppression and erasure of our gender identities and, you know, their role in history. We know that that warming is beginning to have severe climate impacts. So those are the things that I think that, you know, 99% of the people who are listening are going to accept. But my question is for you within that, is nature showing severe signs of strain faster than people would have anticipated? What are the things within the impacts that I've described that are striking you as a person in the center of, as you say, the study of trans ecology?
Everything that you mentioned is really important to lift up. And I don't know to what degree everyone in the queer and trans community actually understands even some of those levels. And I'm thinking particularly of our queer and trans young people in places like Florida, where I just came from, where they aren't allowed to teach things like climate change. So I do want to emphasize that, you know, we need to be teaching some of these basics and not ignoring it. And one framework that I like to use is it comes from organization Movement Generation, Justice and Ecology Project, and they talk about shocks, slides, and shifts. And so shocks are those moments that really grab our attention. They dominate the 24-hour news cycle. They're things like Hurricane Ian that left massive destruction in its wake. But they become disasters because of slides. And so slides are not talked about as often. We talk about a lot in climate change globally is CO2 emissions in the atmosphere, right? There's more and more of this greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, little by little, day by day, more and more every day. But there are these other slides as well. And some of the ones that are top of my mind when we're thinking about the more than human world is biodiversity loss. And this is, I think, underappreciated in terms of how much biodiversity we are losing and how that jeopardizes our lives as humans and the speed at which entire ecosystems, which include us, can rebound after some of these shocks. We lose hundreds of species a day, many of which are sea life and insect life that we don't appreciate for the multifaceted ways that they, through complex relationships, enable us to exist. But, you know, we can look at it on a really simplistic level, like the destruction of mangrove and Everglades and these kind of wetland ecosystems, how the degradation of those over time makes the impacts of these hurricanes worse because we no longer have some of the buffer ecologies that protected communities that lived further inland or would move inland when these hurricanes came, because hurricanes are just part of living on the face of the planet. The disaster isn't the wind and the rain. The disaster is our political, economic, and social system. And so if we move from, you know, thinking about, you know, how is the earth doing right now, moving from thinking about the non-human life to thinking about human life, we are the earth. I think that the kind of diversity loss within our human communities is also something that makes us as a society less resilient to this moment in time. So I'm thinking about biocultural diversity among Indigenous communities that created thousands of years of place-based lifeways and language that encapsulated that understanding of human and more than human interactions that supported thriving, right? And we've lost so much of that. Not that it's gone forever. To be clear that as queer and trans communities, I think it's important for us to say that we're not just anti-normal or anti-establishment, but we need to be anti-colonial, which means being in solidarity and collaboration with Indigenous communities that are reviving these place-based lifeways. And I think that disrupting colonial establishments of gender and these really strictly enforced ways of being and relating with the vast diversity of life all around us is an important component of that solidarity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that's a really powerful point. And I mean, I didn't know that it was, you know, hundreds of species a day that we can be losing. As you say, some microscopic in nature to ones that we don't notice. But I mean, the earth is under severe strain, I think is the response. And I'm wondering if you can talk then about what we mentioned at the top, which is this intersection between the destruction of the environment, this war on our ecological well-being, and also the assault on trans people. Because as you alluded to, there's a lot of connection between those two forces, both in terms of who those organizations are. So I think about the climate skepticism, for example, that's promoted by the Heritage Foundation and how much work they've done to promote the war on trans people, but also in terms of thought, as you said, this idea of them classifying what nature is and then claiming us as being outside of it. So what for you are the deeper kind of pillars of this interconnection between ecological destruction and the war on trans people?
This is fascinating to me. This is what I can't stop thinking about recently and actually compelled me to go back to Florida, connect with some of the folks that I've been in community with there, and start this new film project, Can't Stop Change, because it was on the top of my mind. I mean, actually, the project started when I went down to Florida Atlantic University to talk about fire and flood with a professor, Jane Caputi, who teaches gender and climate change. And this course at FAU has actually been talked about multiple times in the Florida legislature as an example of the pervasive problem of woke academics in the state and the rationale for the need for more of this draconian censorship in higher education. From that moment, I was like, there's something about this connection that they want us to be ignorant of. And when I was there, a friend connected me with some mutual aid activists who have been working since Hurricane Ian to help support, I mean, many frontline communities, including queer and trans people are front of every frontline climate community. And the sentiment was, you know, like I just said, these hurricanes are not disasters because of the wind and the rain. They're disasters because of political, economic, and social systems. And this current wave of legislation is setting us up for a very disastrous hurricane season for multiply marginalized, politically targeted communities in the state of Florida. And so it's from those conversations we launched this effort to create a very rapid media project that could encapsulate this kind of moment in time between when these bills are being signed and before we know how they're going to be enacted in the world and how that's going to impact us. And it's been for me a quest to answer basically what you just prompted to me, which is like, what's beneath this? What's beneath this? And like you said, we know in so many ways, like when it comes to the climate change denialism work, the ways in which, you know, one of the pieces of legislation that passed in Florida is this, they're calling it like an anti-woke Wall Street, anti-environmental investments bill. Basically, no organizations in Florida, public organizations, can make investment decisions based on the environmental, social aspects of a company to invest in. They must do it just on the basis of return, which is a strategy that supports fossil fuels. It supports the kinds of companies that are funding these people's campaigns that they are also invested in personally. So we can see that kind of clearly. But what just grabs me is, but what about the culture war aspects of all of this? How does anti-trans legislation contribute to the extraction, accumulation, and enclosure of wealth among fewer and fewer people? Because that's what's happening, right? How does this culture war? And some people are calling it like a distraction. Like, well, you know, if we just kind of feed the hungry, racist, transphobic masses, they'll ignore this kind of sleight of hand that we're doing that's economically impoverishing them and destroying their homes and communities as well. There's something to that, but I think there's something deeper. It's not just a distraction. There is something about the way in which they're trying to rewrite gender and sex, redefine these very words within a cis heteronormative logic that supports this current extractive economy. And I want to better understand that. The best that I have right now gets down to this idea of progressive neoliberalism, this way in which environmental activism and also our queer and trans activism has been co-opted by a political regime that seemingly is aligned with us, but is actually still very much invested in the current economic system, a neoliberal, extractive, financialization-based system. And that's what leads to kind of this like rainbow capitalism of, you know, Target's Pride collection and so forth. And so then you end up with this very regressive populist backlash because they're seeing this, they can see that this progressive neoliberal system is undermining the way of life for a lot of rural or like Rust Belt communities, white poor communities whose quality of life has consistently been deteriorating under neoliberalism. It's that kind of populism that Trump ran on, you know, even though it is sleight of hand, right? Their policies are actually still very neoliberalism, but it's what they run on. This idea of anti-woke Wall Street is that rejection of a progressive neoliberalism. And so at least what one person I've been reading, Nancy Fraser, says is in order to resist that kind of regressive populism, we need a progressive populism of our own. We need a political party that is anti-neoliberal. And this is a roundabout way of saying that, you know, as we go deeper, 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 when we're looking at the culture wars and climate change, at the root of it is this economic system. And that isn't to say that the culture is a distraction. The culture wars are a tool to continue to engage in that extraction and to pit people against each other that otherwise do have some similar economic interests because they have similar ecological interests in order for us to continue to live on this planet.
I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that I say all the time is that culture war is just not a term that I use. And one of the reasons why is because of what you just pointed out. That's because it's not a cultural war. It is actually the terms of the substantive debate about what matters and who matters, right? And
absolutely.
And so like this idea that there's a battle on the side of the things that matter. No, these are conversations about the things that matter. They're just being framed in these certain ways that we call a cultural war. But you can't, you know, that the ideology around what matters on the planet and who matters on the planet and the way that we then carve up and label people who are unnatural, you know, that's a very real and powerful thing. And the economic forces behind that are a very real and powerful thing. So that's how the planet is doing and that's what the forces are arrayed against it. What do you think is really powerful about the leadership and vision of queer and trans people in overcoming the climate crisis?
There are so many examples of the ways in which queer and trans people have been at the forefront of environmental justice and climate justice movements, but in very invisible ways. And we have not necessarily had clear narratives that explain why it is important to uplift our identities. So I want to say that first and foremost, I don't think that there's a lack of queer and trans leadership in the environmental movement. I've heard some people say that. I think that we need to uplift the fact that we have been. And there are a number of reasons for that. I think on one level, there is this very embodied experience of change and transition that is really useful for engaging in a world that is in the process of change and transition. There's kind of a slogan that keeps coming to mind for me of like trans justice for a just transition. Like we can't ignore the fact that the rights, the capacity, the access to the resources to live in our bodies in a sovereign and expansive and joyful way is necessary for us to make the social, economic, political transformations necessary to live on this planet, and that we need to uplift that. And I think that there's also this level of, and Cleo Wolfhazard writes about this a lot in their book, underflows about trans ecologies. They write that queer and trans experiences of grieving premature death, whether that's from, you know, police, AIDS, suicide, you know, I'd add climate-related disasters, all of these different ways in which our communities are already transforming and transfiguring grief into action is so necessary in order to combat the eco-grief that so many young people are experiencing. As an environmental educator, I think it's really dangerous that so many young people, their first way of learning about the environment in school, let's say that they're in a place where you do teach about climate change, the first things that they learn about the environment are how devastated our ecological systems are before they're taught to love and belong and be in relationship with place and ecology all around us. And I think that that contributes to this growing eco grief. But as a community, as a queer and trans experiences of turning grief into action is a really powerful force for stoking collective action on ecological justice, if we can make those connections. And some of the same strategies apply to this moment of climate change. I do not want to over-focus on the political arena here without thinking about the interpersonal relations of whether you call it mutual aid or caring networks that are literally the lifeline for communities that have been abandoned by the state, right? Like what's happening in Florida is not new. Our communities have been abandoned and neglected by the state for, I mean, since this settler nation was founded. And so we've, through those histories, created alternative structures for meeting people's basic needs for survival. And I don't want to over-glamorize that. I don't think that, you know, all of the ways that we create resilience for ourselves and our communities are useful over the long term because they come out of desperation and need in the moment. But there is also a wealth of strategies to draw upon and a kaleidoscopic diversity of strategies to draw upon, which is, again, diversity is our best defense in the face of climate injustices.
Lastly, on a personal note, what's fascinating to me is that you both work and live in a country that is both hostile to you as a queer person and also to the work that you've devoted your life to do, which is to help save our place on the planet. I say that because the planet's going to go on whether or not we're here or not, but our place on the planet, our place in ecology. And personally, how is this something that you navigate? You know, living in a state that's passed anti-trans laws, other laws, a state that is actively promoting nuclear power and all the rest of it, and regularly working with trans people across the Southeast that are in the path of hurricanes, both political and natural?
To be honest, it has been very rough. And I was not born in the South. I grew up in Maryland and internationally. My parents did different kinds of international work. So I entered the climate justice movement in Kenya, actually learning from Wangari Maathai. And then eventually made my way over to California, and I was kind of politicized into this intersection between queer liberation and ecological justice in a setting that was just so vibrant in both of those arenas, and where success and winning and pushing the edge was just so, felt so energizing and palpable. And the past 5 years of living in the South, I've better understood the weight of oppression that people live under here. But I can't speak to what that feels like growing up lifelong in this area. And there's one other connection to, we've kind of talked about how it doesn't make sense to just keep calling these the culture wars. And I feel similarly when people overemphasize the role of quote unquote Christian values in these debates. I'm quite certain that there are a number of people who are motivated on the right by their Christian values, but being in this land right now where our economic system is still very rooted in the plantation racial capitalism, and remembering that it was quote unquote Christian values that upheld slavery, but it was really a political economic system that made that enduring connection. Yeah, being here in the South has reminded me that there are plenty of people of quote unquote Christian values who have led the civil rights movement, which operated out of churches. Too many people throw away the South, all of it, writ large. And there are so many organizers here working so hard amidst incredibly hostile conditions. And some of the ways that they organize are different from the ways people organize in places like California, but they are working damn hard. And we need to be working in solidarity and alliance with these grassroots movements that are confronting fascism on a daily basis.
Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for your work and coming on to talk about the way in which the transformation of nature and the transformation embodied in trans and queer people go hand in hand, and all of the ways, both energetic and movement-wise. Thank you so much, and we're all sending you the best.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure to be on this show, and thank you for constantly providing a guide and navigation for this moment in time. I'm really grateful to learn from you and to participate in this way.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you again. That was environmental justice organizer and filmmaker Vanessa Raddatz.
Hey, y'all. I'm Erin Haynes, the host of The Amendment, a brand new weekly podcast on gender, politics, and power brought to you by the 19th News and Wonder Media Network. You've probably heard the news that this election year, our democracy is at stake. On The Amendment, I'm breaking down what that actually means, specifically for the marginalized folks who depend on our democracy the most. This is a show that dives past the headlines and gets clear on the unfinished work of our democracy. Listen to The Amendment now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm looking forward to this conversation with Two-Spirit artist, organizer, and abolitionist, Big Wind Carpenter. Big Wind has been fighting for social and environmental justice since the age of 13. As a member of the Northern Arapaho tribe from the Wind River Reservation, they have worked on anti-pipeline campaigns across the country, including the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Tennessee Gas Pipeline, and Line 3. Big Wind has also represented Arapaho Nation at major climate conferences, including the recent United Nations COP28 in Dubai. And they currently serve as the Tribal Engagement Coordinator, helping to protect the environment with the Wyoming Outdoor Council. Outside of their advocacy work, Big Wind also makes music that blends hip-hop, dance, and pop with lyrics dedicated to fighting militarism, capitalism, and resource extraction. Big Wind, thank you so much for joining me today.
Totally. Glad to be here.
Can you tell us when you first felt connected to the land? When did you know that there was a relationship between you and the natural world?
It happened at a very young age. I am a Northern Arapaho tribal member. And so growing up on the Wind River Reservation, it's kind of like told inside of our stories that were told when we're young. Like, we have a creation story, and our creation story talks about how essentially we come from the sky, and then we need everything on the land to help us survive while we're here in this journey. And then someday we go back home to the sky. So I think like hearing that as a kid made me understand that like we need all of these things to live.
I mean, I love that creation story because it essentially underscores that we're magic, you know, and that's actually one of the things that we think of as ourselves as trans people, that we are magic, and it underscores that origin story that we're magic.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing about that is that a lot of Native origin stories from several other tribes talk about sky people as being separate from us. That is to say that there's some form of like extraterrestrial or spiritual beings, but your origin story, the Arapaho story, is essentially that we are sky people.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's funny when people always say, like, we're indigenous to Mother Earth. And I'm like, I'm from the sky. Like,
not me. Speak for yourself.
Yeah.
Is it sometimes strange for you to be a person who lives in the modern world, right? We are all a part of the current system and setup, which tells us essentially that we're separate from nature, that we're the only thing that matters. Humans are the only thing that matters. And that essentially our job is to use all the resources that we want, not think of stewardship or balance, and then we die. Like, essentially, that's kind of what the modern world teaches us. And how do you personally experience that conflict? You know, that conflict of your tradition and what you know to be true, as you just told us, and being a person who lives in the modern world, as we all do.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I would say that those ideas that you talk about are foreign to this land in America, and were brought here, those ideologies. Mother Earth is a living organism. She breathes, she gives life. And so I don't ever think that I'm in control of her rights or that I can take more than I can use. There's this natural law of order that creates this web of life that we're all dependent on. Our attitude needs to change towards Betawu, like Mother Earth. And it's really interesting because dominant society is a taker society in the sense that we do not practice reciprocity at a large scale, where if for us as Arapaho people, we know that if we take something from the earth, then we have to give back. And so when we're like picking berries or chokecherries, we give some tobacco beforehand. We thank the creator, we thank that plant for being able to allow us to receive some of its blessings, that it's going to help us, you know, continue living on. Same thing happens, you know, when we go out on a hunt and we're taking an animal's life, like we thank that animal's life for allowing us to be able to continue up with our own life. And then we use every part of that animal. And what I see with like the dominant society is that there's a lot of taking, there's no giving back, which disrupts that like natural rhythm of things and kind of creates this supremacy over the land and over the other animals that live off of the land, not seeing ourselves as a part of the animal kingdom, as an animal, you know, as ourselves.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. The consequence of the imbalance is something that we're living with more every day. For you, as I've read, your activism actually began around politics at a young age, around, I think, 12 or 13, within your local tribe. Can you tell us about what compelled you to get involved at such a young age?
Like many kids who grew up on reservations or who grew up in communities of color, were often, I think, essentially exploited. I didn't have the words for it at the time. I knew that I needed to do something about it. And the word was that I learned later was environmental racism. I mean, colonization and racism in general. But there were a lot of loopholes that were happening on the reservation. And it allowed for oil and gas to thrive in my community. I grew up at a housing project where the oil and gas fields were right behind the housing project. And then I played in a river, and we didn't know that they were using that creek, which later went into the river, for dissolved solids. So like we were essentially being poisoned, and there wasn't enough public education around it. It's not that our leaders didn't know, they knew, but they weren't informing the tribal members. And so I became activated at a very young age. Around the same time, the county, which the reservation is a part of, was found guilty of diluting Native American vote via gerrymandering. And so the tribes here, the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone, sued the government, essentially the county government, and won in federal court. So they had this special election. I remember very vividly, I was 13 years old. One of my mentors, who's passed on now, the late Eddie Wada, was talking about how the importance of ensuring that our voice is heard to our leaders. And he said a quote that will stick with me for the rest of my life. He said, "We have to be at the table so that we're not on the menu." And I couldn't even vote, you know what I mean? But I'm like going house to house, a housing project to housing project on the reservation, trying to convince Indigenous people to vote. And I mean, I'm a tribal member myself, but I look back in retrospect and I'm like, who is I trying to tell my folks to trust the government? You know, I had a lot to learn as well, you know, in that situation about how to approach it, the right way of going things, and then ensuring that like the right people are running for those. That's kind of how I got involved in activism at a very young age. I essentially joined the youth council on the reservation. We did a get out the vote nonpartisan. We organized cleanups and a lot of meetings with our elected officials to try to figure out some of these environmental issues that were happening on the reservation. I don't know. I feel like I've always been an inquisitive person. Like when I was a kid, there would just be something that was happening and I didn't really understand. I'm like, why is it like that? And my mom would, I think, try to be like, it's always been that way from her like baseline knowledge. Like within her life, it's always been that way. You know, that's just the way it is. And I'm like, no, that's not the way it is. That's not the way this can be like regularly, right? So trying to find solutions for these like complex problems has been pretty much the epitome of my life.
It sounds like as a child, you grew up quickly on the reservation. Do you think that that is true for other people on the reservation, or that was a unique experience to you?
I think that that's like a sad reality that we have to deal with on the reservation. The life expectancy is in your 40s. And so I think for a lot of people, they grew up really young. The average age on the reservation right now is like 19.
Wow. So yeah, by 15 or 20, you're halfway through your life. And so you would grow up fast.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I feel like for me, I hope that one day we can, like my descendants don't have to go through the same situations that we had to go through. But essentially growing up very young, and I had four younger sisters as well. So trying to make sure that they were taken care of in the midst of it all, I think was my priority.
Wow. So in terms of your gender identity, the word in Arapaho essentially translates into what people generally understand as Two-Spirit. But I'm wondering if you can actually take us into the word and its meaning, because it is slightly different, as you say, and has kind of a profound meaning when you unpack it.
Yeah, so the term Two-Spirit actually comes from Ojibwe people up north and has been adopted by essentially indigenous people of North America to mean the same thing across communities. And so for us as Arapaho people, we have what's considered Two-Spirit, and the word for it is hachach, and it means actually hollow bone. And so that there's energy that's always passing through us, and energy is not inherently feminine or masculine. It's active, it's passive. And so when you have a hollow bone, then you're able to accept and receive energy as it is without any alterations, essentially.
Was there a time when you realized that you felt hachach, or was it more of a revelation over time, an unfolding?
I have always kind of known that I've been queer, for sure. Growing up, was definitely effeminate and kind of like knew those things about myself. I didn't really start identifying, I think, as a queer or really accepting kind of that role and responsibility until about 8 years ago. It was like 2016, I think, where I was like, I'm definitely have been, I think, fighting this thing my whole life. Like a queer person on the reservation there, I think in Wyoming, it's still pretty conservative here. And I think I did spend a lot of my teens like trying to fit in into these like societal roles. And then it wasn't until several years ago that I was like, I have to accept this apart myself, and I have to start doing like these roles in my community, because I didn't have anyone to really look up to who was a Two-Spirit person in our community. And then now it's really interesting to see these young hachach people on our reservation growing up and seeing me as a role model. So I'm glad that they have somebody that they can look up to. And I hope that they can be the people that people look up to in the future.
How do these two essential definitions of who you are as a person support each other and propel you? That is to say, your concern for the planet and your organizing around and within that, that started at a really young age, and the fact that you are queer, that you are outside of the gender binary. How do those two things work together? Or maybe an easier way to think about it is, once you were able to accept the fact that you were not within the binary, that you weren't straight, how did your life change?
Yeah, so in 2016, a lot of things were happening. Essentially, there was this pipeline being built in North Dakota called the Dakota Access Pipeline. And
of Standing Rock, right?
Yeah, Standing Rock. And I ended up living there for 6 months with my sibling, who is also Two-Spirit. And essentially, both of us became really involved in Two-Spirit Camp. And I feel like it had been the first time that we had been around community where we didn't feel like it was either just me and my sibling, and that we had that kind of sense of community where we were at a camp where everybody was like us. We started learning more about like essentially the roles that were taken away from us because of colonization. So as a Two-Spirit person, there are certain things that Two-Spirit people do, like we're baby namers, we're song makers. When there's a battle happening, we're called to be an advisor, essentially, because we can come acknowledging that we can bring both energies, that we can come from a more expansive frame of mind, and that our thoughts aren't being limited to one or the other. And so while this like pipeline is being built in our community, I think it was like really important that we were embracing our two-spirit selves and also retaking those roles that our people are supposed to take in spaces like that. I think it's really interesting, you know, like me and my sibling, we both got arrested out there. It really opened my eyes to how a lot of the frontline situations, even though the dudes get a lot of the FaceTime, it's usually queer and femmes who are doing all of the work behind the scenes. And I think that that's indicative of pretty much every movement. I think the people who are facing the brunt of these situations that are the ones that are willing to take the most risk. And I think it was really important for me as a two-spirit person. I went to Northern Minnesota to fight Line 3, and I lived in Northern Minnesota for 3 years fighting this pipeline. But what was different about the campaigns was that there wasn't just one camp where thousands of people were gathered up in Northern Minnesota. There was several camps spread across the route of the pipeline. And all of the camps were created by women, Indigenous women and Two-Spirit people. And so I have, for the past like several years, not only have I like came into my role as a Two-Spirit being, but I've also worked under the leadership of femme and queer Two-Spirit leaders, which I think is kind of allowed me to be the leader that I am today.
It's super powerful. So it's interesting because you're saying that, that Standing Rock was this kind of cauldron where these two parts of yourself actually could coexist, and you saw other people doing the same thing. And it would then explain how you've gone on after Standing Rock to do so many groundbreaking things, you know, organizing unique climate convenings and speaking up for youth and a whole host of other things afterwards. It's interesting that for you, there is kind of a before and after Standing Rock. The essence of who you are, as you've told us, is about channeling the energies, masculine and feminine, without obstruction, which means that the energy does flow through you. And as you mentioned, you know, a role of Two-Spirit people could be for naming or for advising. And I'm wondering, as a person who's dedicated to the climate as you are and who you are as a person, you know, we've experienced so many climate calamities just in the past year, unprecedented. And I'm wondering, what do you think or what do you feel that the planet is trying to tell us?
It's interesting because there is this concept where people say that the world is ending, essentially, that the earth is dying, and that essentially humans are like this parasite just like eating them up or something like that. And I think that may be the reality for some folks, but in my reality and from what I know in our stories, Mother Earth has been here before us and will continue to be here. The like state of which they are will always continue to shift because she's evolving. And needless to say that we see ourselves as something that's supreme over the earth. That's something that can tame her. That's something that can turn her into a resource, essentially. And for me, as a like two-spirit person from where I'm at, like, I think that what Mother Earth is trying to tell us right now is that
we can decide to change our habits. And maybe our predecessors, they didn't actually understand that the actions that they were making had consequences, not only on the environment, on our people, but then later on the climate. But that if we don't decide to change those things, that she will rid herself of us. And so when I think what most people mean when they say the world is ending is really actually based out of a logical fear that humans could cease to exist if we do not change our patterns and our relations that we have with the earth. And that is a harsh reality for the future, that humans could cease to exist and that we essentially caused this to happen. But I think as an indigenous person, this kind of mentality that all humans are a parasite, I think actually comes from like this victim blaming that corporations do on us as people. They tell us to recycle. They tell us that climate change is human caused, all while 70% of climate change was caused by 100 corporations who are not wanting to take responsibility, all while, you know, 80% of the world's biodiversity is being protected by indigenous people, while we only make up less than 4% of the human population. That's not by coincidence. It's because of that connection that we have with Mother Earth. It's because of our technologies, traditional ecological knowledge that allows the environment to thrive because of that reciprocity. We take care of it, so it takes care of us. When we lose that natural law of order, the environment, the nature starts to crumble and it can no longer support us. So people move into different areas and that same kind of cycle has continues to happen. We can decide now that we want to put away this taker society and we want to actually follow the teachings of indigenous people who have community with the land, have communion with the land, and are able to appreciate and treat it the way that it wants to be treated.
We can decide, I think. We can decide.
We can decide.
Big Wind, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the openness and the power that you have brought today. And I am grateful for you and your work and your voice. And we are hoping for many, many, many years of you and your leadership in front of us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That was Two-Spirit artist and activist, Big Wind. Thank you for joining me on the Translash podcast. Now listen all the way through to the end of the show for something extra. If you like what you heard, please go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. You can listen to Translash wherever you get your podcast. Check us out on the web at translash.org to sign up for our weekly newsletter. Follow us on TikTok and Instagram at Translash Media. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. The Translash podcast is produced by Translash Media. The Translash team includes Oliver Ash Klein and Aubrey Calloway. Sandra Adams is our senior sound engineer and a contributing producer. Alex Geha is our social media producer. And digital strategy is handled by Daniela Capistrano. The music you heard was composed by Ben Draghi and also courtesy of ZZK Records. The Translash podcast is made possible by the support of foundations and listeners like you. During this week of April 25th, I am looking forward to the Black Trans Advocacy Conference, known as BTAC, taking place in Dallas, Texas. Of course, there are so many critical issues facing our community, and I'm really looking forward to being in community with everyone there and also hosting the gala, which is going to be my job. I think Raquel Willis is the one moderating most of that, so she'll get the hard job, and then for a change, I get an easy job of hosting a gala. Looking forward to it.